Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard another challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Based on the questions the justices asked and the statements they made, many Supreme Court reporters and health experts say the court will most likely uphold the law. SCOTUS blog tweeted, quote, "There is no chance the Supreme Court is going to invalidate Obamacare." Chief Justice John Roberts, who cast the key vote in 2012 upholding Obamacare, and Justice Brett Kavanaugh suggest that the court may cast aside the individual mandate while leaving the rest of the ACA intact. The individual mandate required all Americans to obtain health insurance or be subject to a financial penalty. In 2017, Republicans reduced the penalty to zero. We're going to play a few clips from the justices. Here is one from Justice Kavanaugh.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Verrilli, but let's assume, just for the sake of argument, assume I don't agree with that, and then we get to severability. I tend to agree with you on that this is a very straightforward case for severability under our precedents, meaning that we would excise the mandate and leave the rest of the act in place, reading our severability precedents. One of my questions is, do you think that's would have been the right result under the 2010 act, or did that change in 2017, or how would you assess that?
That is Justice Kavanaugh, and here is a clip from Chief Justice Roberts.
General Hawkins, on the severance question, I think it's hard for you to argue that Congress intended the entire act to fall if the mandate were struck down, when the same Congress that lowered the penalty to zero did not even try to repeal the rest of the act. I think, frankly, that they wanted the court to do that, but that's not our job.
That is Chief Justice Roberts at yesterday's hearing. Joining us to talk about the hearing and the future of healthcare is Trudy Lieberman, a contributing editor at the Center for Health Journalism. Trudy is a past president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists. She had a long career at Consumer Reports and was a longtime contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review. Trudy has won many national reporting prizes, including two national magazine awards, and she has covered healthcare for many, many years. Hi, Trudy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's always good to be on your show.
Well, it's always great to have you, Trudy. What are your thoughts based on what we just heard from Justice Kavanaugh and Chief Justice Roberts?
Well, I think that's really a positive step here. I had done a blog post a few weeks ago, and one of the legal experts had told me that he thought the Affordable Care Act was holding on by a thread. But it seems to me, based on what the two justices had to say yesterday, it may be hanging on by more than a thread, and that it may stand, and maybe this is the last legal challenge to the law. Let's hope so. It's been to the court a few other times, and maybe the Republicans will stop the challenges to the law, and it will resume to be the law of the land for the future.
Trudy, the individual mandate might be struck down. Can you remind us why the individual mandate was part of the ACA in the first place?
Yeah, that was put in by the committees that wrote the law, and they thought that they needed kind of a stick to make people buy health insurance. Now, just looking back in the history of health insurance, we know that many people, many thousands, millions of people over the years have not bought health insurance unless they were part of Medicare or they got their coverage from an employer, largely because it has always been a relatively expensive purchase. And many people have not been able to evaluate their own risk. And so they would tend to say, well, nothing's ever happened to me. I'm pretty healthy. Nothing will happen to me. But they historically have never looked ahead to what might happen if some unforeseen illness would strike. And we know that that does happen to people all the time. And so most of the people would take a roll of the dice and say, I'm not going to buy it. Well, Congress in the late early first part of the 2000s, late end of the first decade, finally got together with many, many advocates who worked for this law, thought that the time was right to try to get something in place to help all those people who were really disenfranchised from the healthcare system. They didn't belong to Medicare. They were too young. They were too wealthy for Medicaid. They didn't have employer coverage. And so the ACA was really aimed at that great swath of Americans that did not have coverage or were reluctant to buy coverage or didn't have the money for various reasons, didn't have it. And so the ACA, if we take a step back in history, we see that it was targeted to primarily those groups of people who were disenfranchised from health care and health insurance because they had no way to pay for the care. So the law was passed after a great struggle. It was never popular among Republicans, and it was never popular among some segments of the population. There were some dislocations. Some people had to give up their, what they call their good coverage. Remember, if you like what you have, you can keep it, those people in that group. And so some people did have to lose some of that coverage, and some of that coverage was deemed not really acceptable coverage under the ACA. But by and large, over the years, the people got used to it, and many people came in and out of the system that was set up. And I think looking back on it, it probably has been a pretty good success for the country. I'm one of these people who believed all along that we should have and still need to go much further than we did with the Affordable Care Act. But that said, there have been many, many thousands, millions perhaps, of people who've been helped by the law. That's not to say that assuming the Supreme Court gives the green light to the ACA once and for all, and that seems to be the direction that they're heading in, that there aren't many challenges that still await. And if you have a little time here, I want to discuss them because I think the affordability issue is looming very large. And it's looming very large in this open enrollment season. I just was spending some time on the Covered California website to find out exactly what kind of policies were being offered. And what I found were fair number of policies. There is no problem for lack of choice here. So we have to take that particular argument off the table. But the prices of the policies, not only in California, but in my state of New York and all across the country. I also looked at the Oregon website today, too, and I have not finished my research for the day. I'm sure I'm going to find more when I move across the country. What I'm finding is that the cost sharing on some of these policies is really, really high. And what do I mean by high cost sharing? I'm just going to give you an example of a couple of policies I found on the Covered California site from one company in the state. This is for a bronze policy, supposedly one of the lower price policies. There was a per individual deductible on this policy of $6,300 and a family deductible of $12,600. Now, those amounts were lower than what I found in some of the Oregon policies, where I found them going up much higher. And I'm sure that if I look in New York, I'm going to find out-of-pocket costs going up into $18,000, $19,000, which I have found before. So the problem is this. Unless a family qualifies for cost-sharing subsidies or premium tax credits that help them buy the policy in the first place, they are going to have a lot of trouble really getting what they need. And one can make the argument that some of these policies, are they really insurance, or are people better off just putting the money in a bank and self-insuring? So we haven't solved the cost problem at all. And recall that there really is very minimal cost containment in the ACA, and that was its biggest omission, I think, when the law was going through. And the reason for that is the reason we don't have a national health insurance program is that the stakeholders in this country don't really want to have the prices controlled. And they lobby hard to make sure that doesn't happen. And so I fear that even with the ACA as it survives going forward, is going to be a financial challenge for certain people at certain income levels that are not eligible for these subsidies. And I believe that the President-elect Biden had said at one point during the campaign that he was interested in increasing some of those cost-sharing subsidies or premium tax credits. And if that happens, that would be a good thing. The question is, how much of that can he really accomplish with the Republicans in control of the Senate and the Democrats with a very slim margin going forward?
Right. Well, we're going to be with Trudy for about 10 or so more minutes. So if you have any questions for her about the ACA, the future of the ACA, and what a Biden administration could accomplish with or without a Democratic Senate. I mean, if the two senators in Georgia do not win, it's going to be hard to get anything done. We'll talk about what he could do with executive actions. The Washington Post pointed out this morning that even if those two Georgia senators win, it'll be 50-50. Kamala Harris will have the tie vote, but someone like Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, the Senate's most conservative Democrat, might not agree to a public option. So Trudy, to your point about cost, those of us who have high deductibles, I have a ridiculously high deductible. I was just on the phone for hours yesterday with my insurance company, just trying to get basic answers to basic questions like, is my annual exam covered? And it took forever just to get an answer. With a public option, how could that change things? Would costs come down significantly? How do you see that playing out?
Well, I think they could. And I think the fear that the injection of the public option into our health insurance arrangements might really do something toward reducing prices of policies and insurance. And that explains why the industry is very much against this. There's been a coalition of stakeholders, insurance, hospitals, and so forth, that have been very active over the last year or so, trying to build a coalition among themselves, but also sort of soften up the public for not going along with the public option. And I've been watching their tweets over the years and over these months, I should say. And they've been pretty vigorous and pretty active. And I suspect that not only that group, but there will be other industry groups, drug companies, insurance, hospitals, doctors, so forth, anyone who has any kind of business, substantial business with the health industry, which is a whole lot of folks, they will be very interested in making sure that their profits are somehow protected. And if we look back to the history of health insurance arrangements in this country, that has always been the stumbling block. It certainly was during Clinton's years when he tried something. It was always an issue with Obamacare. It is an issue now. It was an issue when I first started covering this stuff in the 70s and 80s, that is really the elephant in the room here. And until we come to grips with that, I think we're going to have a very difficult time changing the paradigm and the increasing costs people are facing.
Biden says he also wants to expand access to Medicare, giving people the option to enroll at age 60. It's now 65. How could he bring down the age, Trudy? Could he do that without a Democratic Senate, or does he need a Democratic Senate?
I don't think I know the answer to that, Rose. Whether he can do that by executive action or that there has to be some sort of congressional approval. Most observers believe that that is a good thing. Certainly the people in that age group, I've seen correspondence for them over the years that they tell me, well, they're 58, you know, they're just counting the years until they can become 65 and become Medicare eligible. Because the people in that age group of maybe have lost their jobs. We've had a lot of job loss this year and in previous years in that age group. It's not just, you know, this year that there's been a problem. People in their 50s and early 60s have been let go at great numbers over the last several years. So those are the people who are really hurt when they have to go into the market to buy insurance, because we know that at older ages, it costs a lot more money. Someone at age 50 is going to pay a lot more money for coverage than someone age 35. And when we do these comparisons and when the press does these comparisons, they always pick a male at age 35 or 40. And I'm thinking how deceptive, because those are the ages that's probably going to be the lowest. But when you talk about the people who have lost employer coverage, say a 55-year-old or a 60-year-old, that's when the prices are really going to be high, because they present a greater health risk to the insurer. Mm-hmm. That's just how it works. So I think it would be a boon to that age group to be able to buy into Medicare with its very large risk pool that makes it possible to insure, you know, millions of Americans at a relatively low cost. But I think we can look forward to a lot of objections to that, probably from the stakeholders that I mentioned earlier, certainly from many people in Congress. I would guess Republicans have gotten a lot of contributions from these people, and maybe some Democrats even would oppose that. But I think it would be a step in the right direction if we could ever pull it off.
To your point about misinformation and how effective it is, Trudy, the Kaiser Family Foundation has a piece that I think says it all. A conundrum. Majority of Republican voters want to overturn the ACA, but keep protections for people with pre-existing conditions.
Yeah. Well, that's always the way it's been. They want their own protections, but they don't see the larger picture. And the larger picture that they don't see, that everyone needs to be in the risk pool. That's the way all the other countries work it. Everyone has health insurance. It's the way Medicare works, that you have large numbers of people so that the risk can be shared among a lot of people, so that someone at age 65 or 75 or 85 who's likely to have healthcare conditions, because that's just the way things work, can get relatively inexpensive care. But that means that someone who is 25 will have to pay some of that cost. It's all pooled together. But the 25-year-old or the 35-year-old doesn't want to pay that, because they're saying, you know, I'm never going to get sick. Or the 55-year-old says, why should I pay for maternity care for a 35-year-old, because I'm never going to get pregnant. So there's got to be a change in the way we view communality here. And I think that solidarity that we see in France and England and Canada and Germany is just something that has been missing here, except in our Medicare program and in Social Security. Mm-hmm. And those two programs, that kind of pooling together of the risk, works very well. And we've accepted it all through these years. But for some reason, when it comes to health insurance, we see it in a different way. And I think until we can get to the point that we can see how we have to sort of share, and that you pay for coverage for people who need it, because someday you're going to need it too. And that's the younger person in Medicare doesn't need as much care as someone who's 85 or 90, let's face it. Mm-hmm. And so until we can get to that point, I think we're still going to have trouble.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Todd in Oakland. Hi, Todd. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Yes, keeping in mind that, I mean, the ACA thing is the most immediate thing going on, but it doesn't, I mean, you know, the conversation doesn't seem to involve the costs of, you know, hospital care or the pharmaceuticals and so forth. And it's not, I don't know, there just seems like it's a a multifaceted battle, but we seem to mostly focus on, and again, because it's in the news and Supreme Court and everything, but ACA seems to be just the focus, but there seems to be a larger battle, for lack of a better term, to be discussed. I mean, that needs to come up in conversation.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. Hospital costs, drug costs. Trudy, this is just a massive issue.
Yes,
it is. So many layers to this.
And the caller is spot on. The cost issue was practically avoided, not discussed in the campaign. The only person or group that I remember bringing up costs very much was David Mitchell's drug group, the Affordable Drugs Group, that has relentlessly been after the costs of drugs. And they've had in 15 states during the campaign, they had a lot of people who have been unable to afford their drugs, especially the $20,000 a month biologics for things like Crohn's disease and other maladies. These people can't afford these drugs without help. And we're not just talking about, amoxicillin if you have a slight cough or something. We're talking about really big ticket drugs. But aside from what they tried to do during the election, I can think of very little to no discussion of any of the costs. So the caller is spot on. And this really needs to be front and center as we go forward. And I think it's up to the media to bring this up and to continue to talk about it. It's up to advocacy groups to keep hammering away at this. It seems like our thought processes have so narrowed in what we're willing to talk about, what we're willing to write about, when I think the public is way ahead of us here. We just have to lead them.
And final thoughts, Trudy. Yesterday, NPR had a piece about this issue, and Larry Levitt with the Kaiser Family Foundation said many parts of Biden's plan is likely dead in the water if Republicans maintain control of the Senate. And they were talking about some of the things he can do with executive actions, but I think we need to dig a little deeper in that and figure out what he can and cannot do. And I just wondered, why the Dems didn't spend more time on the campaign trail saying, we want to expand access to Medicare. We want to ensure that you have a public option. But we can only do that if the Democrats win back the Senate.
Well, I think that what the Dems didn't do, and I think that I pointed this out in a recent post, paraphrasing what Politico reporter said, that the Democrats made this a referendum on Trump. And the talk was all about Trump primarily. There was not really a lot of substance about some of these issues like drug prices or what's going to happen to the Medicare and Social Security trust funds. I think I'm one of the only reporters, maybe the only one, that's talking about this. Those trust funds are running low. And they need to be replaced with more money. And Congress has been ducking that issue for a long time, Democrats included. But if they're not addressed, that means that those benefits will be reduced under Medicare and under Social Security. And we can consider Social Security a health issue as well, since so many people depend on it and use that income to pay for all these out-of-pocket costs and drug costs and so forth. And I think that the Democrats probably missed the boat here, that they have not discussed this. They've made it a referendum on Trump. And in doing so, they have neglected a lot of these issues that need to be brought up.
Well, Trudy, we'd love to have you back for the full hour to go over this, especially when we find out what happens in Georgia with those two Senate races. Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor at the Center for Health Journalism and a longtime healthcare reporter. Thank you so much for joining us, Trudy.
Thanks, Rose. Always good to be with you.
Great to have you. And we got a number of emails over the last couple days about, actually, it was just yesterday we had Jane McAlevey on. It's been a long couple of weeks. Jane McAlevey talked Monday about putting together a list of grassroots organizations that you can support in Georgia. We do have that list, and we will put it on our website right now. It's yourcallradio.org. You can find that list of organizations on the ground in Georgia, yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, we will speak with activists on the ground to talk about the Latino vote. Latinos were key for Joe Biden in key states. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Well, we're still waiting for extensive voting data, but we do know that Latinos voted in record numbers this year. Thanks to grassroots organizing and a lot of hard work, more than 19 million Latinos voted, and they supported Joe Biden over Donald Trump by a 2-to-1 margin, according to a new NBC News, Wall Street Journal, Telemundo poll. Joining us to talk about all of this are three guests. Eduardo Sainz is Arizona State Director of Mi Familia Vota, a national civic engagement organization that unites Latino, immigrant, and allied communities to promote social and economic justice. And Eduardo joins us from Phoenix. Hi, Eduardo. Welcome back to the show. Oh, Eduardo is going to join us in just a couple minutes. We're also joined by Tori Gavito, co-founder and president of Way to Win, a national progressive donor collaborative in Texas. Hi, Tori. Welcome back to the show. Do we have Tori? All right, let's try Laura Martin, executive director of PLAN, Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada. It was founded in 1994, and they transform progressive ideas into policy through grassroots organizing and policy advocacy. Hi, Laura, are you with us?
I am here.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, Laura, there was so much news about the Latino vote before the election. For about 2 months before the election, we had on so many guests who were concerned that the Biden team did not do enough advocacy in Latino communities. Before we get into all that, I just wonder, how are you feeling right now? I mean, it's been a long couple of weeks, and Latinos voted in record numbers this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, one, thank you for having me on. But yes, it's been, I would argue, a long 4 years, and we finally got to this moment. Because of the vote by mail election, it's taking a little bit longer. You would think a place like Las Vegas could maybe send in some blackjack dealers to help with the count, but we're doing things correctly. We're doing things accurately to make sure all the votes are counted properly and accounted for. So yes, it's going to take us a little bit longer, but most of us have been waiting 4 years for this moment.
It has been a very long year, 4 years. What can you tell us about what you heard from Latino voters in Nevada? Because there was such an amazing ground game during the primaries with the Bernie team. The Bernie team did really unprecedented work on the ground in Nevada. How did that really translate over to people working with and voting for Biden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was really important just to focus on people's stories and listening to what they needed and what they wanted. I think it's no mystery that Joe Biden wasn't folks' first choice in Nevada or other primary states. But the COVID crisis really gave people an opportunity to really just think about who is actually going to think about their families, empathize with their families, especially here in Nevada, where we depend so much on gambling and tourism. Mm. And, you know, COVID shut all that down. But I also want to lift up, more importantly, and why I'm so glad Tori is part of this interview is, you know, Way to Win invest in people long term, not just for the election. And so Plan Action in Nevada with our partners, we were also able to pass in previous years automatic voter registration, which in the first week of implementation, 6,000 people took advantage of it. We also passed same day voter registration. So in the general election, 50,000 people registered to vote the same day they showed up to vote. And we also were able to pass a legislation that automatically re-enfranchised formerly incarcerated people. And that was 77,000 people who benefited from that. So, you know, well over 100,000 people possibly were able to participate in this election. And it's because of long-term, stable, in-state in-state organizing from groups, and it's also because of the investment of groups like Way to Win that we're able to do that organizing here in Nevada.
Really incredible. We've got 95% of the votes reported in Nevada, and right now Biden is leading 50.2% to 47.5%. I mean, you know, yeah, there's 50,000 or so votes difference, but it's pretty, still pretty close in Nevada. So the organizing that you and other groups have done really did make a difference here.
Yeah, it did make the difference. We like to say not only the Latinx community, the Black community, and also the Indigenous community that we were able to really fold into our electoral program that includes a lot of the rural, mostly Republican-leaning districts, but include those folks in our programs. And also there are new and emerging organizations that do more civic engagement in the Indigenous communities. And so again, Joe Biden wasn't a lot of people's first choice. So we really had to focus on having those hard conversations with people about voting and about who's actually here for your family, as well as looking at down ballot races to, instead of Biden providing coattails, those down ballot races lifting Biden up. We were fortunate enough in Las Vegas to elect 7 women public defenders, 4 of them Black women, 1 a Latinx woman, all the first to be elected in those positions. Previously, women of color in those positions were appointed by the governor. And so that's historic and that's unprecedented. But also making sure people know about these elections is another encouragement for them to come out and vote. Even if they're not, you know, 100%, you know, riding with Biden, they're at least looking at these judicial races or their school board or their county commission. And so that is how the on-the-ground organizing really helped push Biden over the edge.
Laura Martin is Executive Director of Plan Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada. And now I'd like to welcome our other guests. Tori Gavito is co-founder and president of Way to Win, a national progressive donor collaborative in Texas. Hi, Tori. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good.
So Tori, I want to ask you the same question. After 4 long years, how are you doing, given all the incredible work you and your colleagues have done in Texas?
You know, we feel good. We feel a little tired, but we keep moving forward. I mean, we have to be very clear about the big picture in Texas that we are on trend, like Arizona, like Nevada, like Georgia. Joe Biden won 46% of the vote in Texas. This is the first time a Democrat president has broken the 45% margin in 44-year history since Jimmy Carter. He earned about 1.3 million more votes than Clinton. That's a 3% jump up over her performance. And this is the third consecutive cycle that Dems have increased the advantage, not just in Harris County, which overlays Houston, which got a lot of love in the early vote because of the innovations out there, but also in 21 counties along the I-35 corridor. That's the interstate that runs from Laredo to Dallas all the way up to Minnesota. So we are on track on a 10-year plan, just like it took Virginia 10 years, Arizona 10 years, Georgia 10 years to really rebuild and expand an electorate. There's a lot more to do, obviously, particularly in unpacking this Latino vote question. No doubt Latinos both propelled Democrats and also turned out for Donald Trump. And that's something that we have to examine.
Right. And we're definitely going to examine that in the coming weeks. To your point about massive voter turnout in Texas, according to the Texas Observer, looking at early voting, more than 1 million voters under the age of 30 had cast a ballot.
Yeah. And there's no way with the change in demographics that those 1 million voters aren't being propelled by Latinos. So what I think we're seeing in Texas is a couple of things. First of all, you know, if we've said it before, we've said it a million times since Tuesday, the Latino vote is not a monolith. Nationally, it's not a monolith in Texas. We've got Latinos on the border. We've got Latinos in cities. We've got rural Latinos. We've got suburban Latinos. There's just a lot of people in Texas and a lot of terrain. And what I think we're seeing is that we're not necessarily seeing big trends in swing. What we're seeing is big trends in turnout with a splinter. So you've got young Latinas, young Latinos who are aligning with Biden, aligning with progressive values. And you have another set of Latinos who never voted before, who are actually, you know, moving in the right-wing direction. But what's interesting is when you look at high-performing Latino counties, particularly around Harris County, you're not necessarily seeing those trends of choosing Republicans or, you know, or not choosing Biden, rather, actually trending down ballot. So, for example, Crystal Castañeda, who was running for Railroad Commission in Texas, which is a statewide office, was actually outperforming Biden in some of the same precincts where some Latinos were showing up and voting Republican for the first time. And, you know, Crystal Castañeda is actually not Latina, but the name is certainly a signal. And we think that Latinos really were looking for those signals about who would stand with their values. And it's a sign for us that we can't, as Texas Democrats, we can't roll into 2022 with a slate that doesn't include Latino leadership, period. And I would say Latina leadership.
Tori Gavito is co-founder and president of Way to Win, a national progressive donor collaborative in Texas. Now I'd like to welcome Eduardo Sainz to the show. Eduardo is the Arizona State Director of Mi Familia Vota. Hi, Eduardo. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be with you all today.
Well, Eduardo, Arizona got so much attention this time around. Right now, 99% reporting, Biden 49.4%, Trump 49.1%. Tell us about the incredible organizing you all have done in Arizona to get out the Latino vote.
Absolutely. Mi Familia Vota has remained hopeful, ensuring that we can build a Latino political power in the state. And we know that we couldn't do that alone. We have such a strong coalitions at the state level with our partners, Lucha, with the MEAC coalition that are helping us fight this fight and build this electoral power. For the last 15 years, we've been asking our communities to get registered, to get on the PEBL, which is a permanent early voting list, getting people to vote from the conference of their home, assisting hundreds of new citizens to become naturalized so they could participate in our democracy. And that's what we saw on election night on November 3rd in Arizona. All of those individuals that we've been having conversations for the last 15 years showed up and we're ready to say enough of racism. We need to see a change in Arizona. And that's why we're seeing the results that we're seeing today. It is no coincidence that our communities are participating. We have been beat up by the Republican-led legislature from SB 1070 days, the Show Me Your Papers laws, when this community, our communities have been asked to show their papers, no matter if we were undocumented or not, but just because of our color of our skins, of our accents. And we have been taking out all of those elected officials that have been racist, promoting racist policies out of office. We talk about Joe Arpaio removing him in 2016 and passing one of the most progressive minimum wage increases for Arizona in 2016, being able to elect the first Latina to be the mayor of Tucson, and also being able to see all of the victories and flipping the state in 2020 has been a long time organizing and building the Latino political power in the state of Arizona.
I'm sure you also played a major role in flipping a crucial Senate seat to a Democrat, Mark Kelly. That was huge. And then Arizona voters also approved Proposition 208, a measure that would raise taxes for educator salaries by taxing the state's highest earners.
That is correct. We're looking at our communities saying enough of this. Our, you know, when we were doing canvassing this election cycle, I was able to see and hear all of these stories of Latino parents truly breaking down at the doors because our kids are suffering. We are rated at the lowest when it comes down to investment in our schools for public education. And we said enough of this. We need to make sure that our kids are thriving in our public education system. We need to ensure that that we see real change and real policies. And for example, we were able to flip the Senate again. This was because of record numbers of Latino turnout that we've been able to see all of this great change in the state of Arizona. And it has taken 10, 15 years of building this Latino political power. And because of the investment of Mi Familia Vota and other groups into the communities to ensure that they could participate, that they're ready to go. And there's no coincidence that our community has been hit the hardest when it comes down to COVID. And we were there trying to respond to from providing assistance to how to apply for unemployment, to how to where was the nearest food bank for individuals to be able to provide food to the table, or from mental health assistance. And as we were having those conversations and checking with our communities, then we were asking them to participate and ensure that we get elected officials that were aligned with our values and that would prioritize our communities for the better of our state and for the better of the country.
Eduardo Saenz is Arizona State Director of Mi Familia Vota. I'd love you all to talk with us about what you think, what message this sends to the Democratic Party, because so many people, including a few of you, have been on the show saying that the Biden ground game just wasn't strong enough in Latino communities. So, Laura, you're in Nevada. What message do you think this election sends the Democratic Party, especially when it comes to the Latino vote?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And I will say, I don't know the details of what their ground game actually was. But I can definitely speak to progressive partners, labor partners who are here consistently and just know that in order to reach a very transient population, and especially in Southern Nevada, and just to reach folks in general, is we have to be here year round, and we have to be able to put as many boots on the ground as possible to reach folks. We also had the added the added issue of COVID, which some folks chose not to knock doors, which is fine. Some people just dropped lit without interacting with people on the doors, but face-to-face contact is the best way to connect with people. But definitely campaigns that come into the state for president, or, you know, in 2022, we're going to have a U.S. Senate and governor's race, is investing early, hiring from the community and not just bringing in people from out of state, and really running a culturally competent campaign. Don't use Google Translate to translate your materials, but really learn exactly what these community needs and how they need them. I think that is what really helped, at least on our end, on our side of things, to really connect people during a pandemic and get people out to vote and comfortable also with a new process of voting, which was vote by mail, which typically Nevadans only do in very, very small numbers, but added to the record turnout this time around.
Tori, you're in Texas. What would you add?
Well, I just want to underscore what Laura is saying about start early. We know that the 2022-2024 landscape continues to look south and southwest on where we see Senate pickups, gubernatorial races, continued marches towards those state legislatures. There's nothing but possibilities and opportunity in the south and southwest. It's why Way to Win, for example, has doubled down, supported groups like Laura's, supported Mi Familia Vota in Arizona and Texas and other places. And we'll continue to do that early because there's just no shortcuts. We have to do local organizing, the hard work of voter registration, talking about why elections are important, setting the stakes. A clever ad or a clever app 3 days before an election is just not going to cut it. Mm-hmm. And we can't expect a community to jump in line ready to vote for Democrats when we haven't done that hard work in between cycles. And frankly, like thinking about what that hard work in between cycles looks like, it is about talking about what Democrats will do for a new emergent majority in terms of jobs, education. These are really nuts and bolts matters that we've got to get right, because certainly after COVID, our communities are not faring well. This is a really hard time for a lot of communities. And the last thing I just want to say is, let's just once and for all treat Texas like a battleground. If the GOP were looking at the same data that I'm looking at, where for three consecutive cycles, Dems have increased their advantage in all major metros of the state, in California, let's say the tables were turned, there's no way they wouldn't pounce to take those electoral backs for those electoral votes back for their column. So let's just do this. I mean, the reason why we're having this conversation about the progress in Houston, but maybe, you know, backward trends along the border, is because organizers in Texas have always had to make tough choices about where to put our resources, because we've never been given the resources needed to actually talk to everyone in our community. now's the time. The opportunity is just too big to miss.
To that point, Tori, you were featured in a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle, and you said that the most effective way that California donors could get involved in all of this, because our state just goes overwhelmingly blue, is to give grassroots groups in red and swing states the money and then let them decide how to spend it. On Monday, labor organizer Jane McAlevey was on the show saying it's absolutely ridiculous that the Democrats spent hundreds of millions of dollars on these Senate races that they ended up losing. That money could be far better spent giving it to organizations like yours. I mean, when you think about Cal Cunningham conceding yesterday in North Carolina, the Democrat there, these campaigns spent a whopping $282 million. So even if you slice that in half, let's say it's $140 million on the Democratic side, what could your groups do with just a small percentage of that money?
I mean, let's ask Laura Martin, how many voters could you register for $140 million? I mean, that's the question, is like, how many young people can we invest in? How many new voters can we invest in? How many deep conversations can we have with folks like the Latinos along the border who, you know, need to see job growth for once? The economy in South Texas has been failing, and COVID, of course, has just kind of has been the death knell. And so, you know, I think about the deep organizing and the kind of path ahead for us. I would also say quickly that the community groups should be getting their leaders in line to run for office. Cal Cunningham in North Carolina was not a champion for progressive values and was not from the community that represents a new, you know, emergent majority in North Carolina. There was a local group that we supported, Poder North Carolina, who had a whole advertising campaign about Concha Cal. And the idea was that, you know, he may be the stale concha left behind at the bakery. The conchas, for those that don't know, are pastry, like Mexican pastries. He may be that old pastry, but he'll do. And it's just like, how on earth are we supposed to mount massive movement campaigns behind that kind of leadership? And the people in the states who have been organizing for a long time have leaders that they could really, you know, prop up. Stacey Abrams is a great example of when math and movement and strategy all meet. And, you know, someone who's done the hard work of registering voters and talking to everyone. I mean, Georgia is definitely an example of how we move forward.
Mm. Eduardo, you're in Arizona. What would you add?
I think it's going back into the investment in the communities of color, ensuring that we have what we need to participate. There has been a huge lack of investment when it comes down to the Latino community, when it comes down to communities of color, into inviting our communities to participate in democracy. And as we are, organizations like Mi Familia Vota and Lucha and others in the state and all across the country, we are filling those gaps that have been filled by the current infrastructure that we have with the political parties, with the candidates. They're not talking to our communities, and we have to be the ones investing in filling that gap and ensuring that our communities are prioritized when it comes down to access to jobs, or prioritizing communities to have a better public education system. And I do believe that as we are investing with these communities, everybody's paying attention because we're looking at the results. But it's been in Arizona a 10-15 year battle of investing and putting our prioritizing our communities. I do believe that early investment needs to be happening in communities of color, year round investment. You know, we have a campaign with over 500 staff members just at Mi Familia Vota in Arizona. And unfortunately, because of the lack of year-round investment, a lot of those individuals that are very talented have to go back and do the regular operations, from going back and being at a restaurant, or going back and being a housekeeper, etc. So as we are thinking about how we win elections and how we build the new electorate, we need to ensure that our communities are invested to thrive and to be those leaders that we need them as we're moving forward in this democracy.
That's such an important point, because to do this work full time, is it possible to do it while being able to pay the bills, feed your families, and actually live a life with dignity rather than having to get a second job?
Absolutely. And I think that that's what we promote. We promote a living wage. We promote access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that as we're promoting those issues, we're also not hypocritical, but we are offering those same type of benefits and pay rates to our individuals that are helping us build this fight, and ensuring that as we are thinking of winning elections, it is a fraction of the cost to invest year round on local nonprofits than just throwing all of this money late for political candidates and just spending it all on TV.
Right.
So I think that we have a bigger impact when we invest in communities.
Well, thank you all for joining us. We'd love to have you back, especially to talk about the message, because there is a pretty intense conversation happening right now between moderate Democrats and progressive Democrats. You know, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say that those who ran on a Medicare for All platform actually won their races. The question is, can you do that in more conservative parts of the country? So we'd love to have you back to talk more about that. Eduardo Sainz is Arizona State Director of Mi Familia Vota. Tori Gavito is co-founder and president of Way to Win in Texas. And Laura Martin is Executive Director of Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada. Thank you all so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back soon.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And yes, we definitely will be posting the organizations in Georgia on our website. We just got a few emails from some listeners just now. We'll put that up right now for organizations you can support on the ground in Georgia. We'll be doing shows about Georgia in the coming weeks. Tomorrow, we will talk about massive voter turnout among Black communities across the country. And then next week, we'll talk about voter turnout among Native communities across the country. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio going. And if you have any show ideas or guest ideas for the coming weeks, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.